It's 98-0101 CR State v. Martwick. And Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mohler will present the state's position.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mohler, representing the petitioner, State of Wisconsin. This matter is here on the state's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals for District 3, which reversed the conviction of the defendant, Thomas Martwick, for manufacturing tetrahydrocannabinol. That conviction was entered in the Circuit Court for Price County, the Honorable Patrick Madden presiding. There are two issues before the court in this case. First, what is the correct standard for reviewing a trial court's determination on the scope of curtilage? Is such a determination an essentially factual one, which should be upheld unless clearly erroneous? Or is such a determination a question of constitutional fact, which is subject to this court's independent review? Second, applying the correct standard of review to the facts in this case, should this court uphold the trial court's determination that the marijuana plants found in buckets on Markwick's property lay outside the curtilage of his home, so that the snipping of a leaf from one of these plants was not a Fourth Amendment violation? Before addressing these issues, I'd like to briefly summarize the facts in this case and to give the court some idea of the physical layout of the Martwick property. On June 9th of 1997, Deputy Brian Rausch of the Price County Sheriff's Department went to the Price County District Attorney to see if he had enough information to obtain a search warrant for the residence of Thomas Martwick. The deputy had learned from another officer that a confidential informant had seen large amounts of processed marijuana at the Martwick home on May 3rd, approximately 5 weeks earlier. The district attorney advised the deputy that this information was too stale to form the basis for a search warrant. So the deputy said he would go back to the Martwick property to obtain some more information. Deputy Rausch, accompanied by Deputy Jarosinski, then returned to the area and got permission from a neighbor to park on the neighbor's property. From there, the two officers walked through the woods where they came across marijuana plants that were growing in 5-gallon buckets. According to Deputy Rausch, you could not really tell when you had entered the Martwick property. There were no specific fences separating the two, or there were no signs indicating that you had gone from one property onto another. The deputy, however, did have a general idea of where the Martwick property was, because he knew that the lots in that area were shaped a certain way, and he knew that Martwick had between 1 and 2 acres of land there. And while they looked at these plants in buckets, the deputy and the other deputy noticed that there was also this rather rough path, kind of trampled down grass, and that the buckets were off to the side. But from where the plants were discovered, all that you could really see were woods, grass, and weeds, and in the distance, you could glimpse the Martwick residence. Now, there's a photograph in the record, which I believe is Exhibit 27, and I'd ask the court to look at this. It was taken from the location of where the buckets were found, and you pretty much see a lot of greenery, a lot of leaves on trees, and you can see in the distance an outline of the home.
The wood line passing Exhibit 27 across.
Thank you. The wood line started about 20 feet out from the Martwick residence, and the lot itself had sides that were irregular. The largest side was approximately 400 feet, and the shortest 200. After snipping a leaf off of one of the plants growing in the buckets, the deputies returned to the DA's office where they tested the leaf, and it turned out to be positive for tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active ingredient in marijuana. At that point, they obtained a search warrant for the property, went back there within 3 hours to execute the warrant, and discovered not just the plants that they had found outside, but also inside the premises, an additional 29 plants and a lot of items that are associated with marijuana growing. The first question this court is asked to decide is, what is the proper standard for reviewing the trial court's determination that a given piece of land falls within or without the curtilage? The Court of Appeals, in this case, correctly believing itself bound by its prior announcement in State versus Kennedy, held that the scope of curtilage is a question of constitutional fact in which the appellate court looks at the historical facts found by the trial court and upholds those facts unless they are contrary to the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence, but then makes an independent judgment as to whether land falls within the curtilage, viewing that as a question of constitutional fact. However, as the state pointed out in its brief, the Kennedy decision was in turn based on an incorrect reading of the Court of Appeals' earlier decision in State versus Lange. In Lange, the Court of Appeals had noted that there was some confusion as to what the appropriate standard of review was, but the Lange court did not decide which standard to use, finding that the result would have been the same under either standard. But subsequent to Lange, somehow the Court of Appeals read Lange as coming down on the side of finding that curtilage is a question of constitutional fact, and this statement has been repeated in numerous decisions of the Court of Appeals since then. But there's really never been a considered analysis given to this issue. So this court now has the opportunity to decide whether it will uphold the Court of Appeals decision that the question is one of constitutional fact, or whether it will follow the lead of the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals and find that the question of curtilage is an essentially factual determination, reviewable only for clear error.
Counsel, is the question of the scope of the search with regard to curtilage to be distinguished from the scope of search, for instance, that's incident to a lawful arrest? And if I may continue, that's the question. But I see our recent case of State versus O'Brien last year that it was written by Justice Wilcox, and it was with regard to search, whether the facts satisfy the constitutional requirements of reasonableness of a search presents a question of law, which we review independently. And then he cites the Frye case, and the Frye case dealt with the scope of a search incident to a lawful arrest. And again, emphasized that this is it's a two-part historical fact, clearly erroneous. Then the constitutional component is reviewed de novo. Those cases cause me concern in being able to support your position. The additional U.S. Supreme Court case of Ornelius, which I thought, although not specifically at curtilage, again dealt, if I recall, with the scope of the search. It says, we hold that as a general matter, the determinations of reasonable suspicion and probable cause should be reviewed de novo on appeal, take to review findings of fact historically and only for clear error, and then the constitutional is the second component that we do de novo. Maybe I'm wrong. I guess I'm perhaps not necessarily correct on that. But how do you respond to that two-part scope of review?
Well, I think that in the cases that you're citing where you're actually deciding whether something was reasonable has really already been answered here in the sense that it's been determined by the United States Supreme Court that you cannot have a reasonable expectation of privacy in land that lies outside the curtilage. So that reasonableness inquiry has already been pretty much answered. And the issue you're looking at is this particular piece of land in or outside the curtilage? And although the four factors that the United States Supreme Court provided in Dunn are not like a mechanistic formula by any stretch of the imagination, all of those factors are purely legal determinations that you can objectively determine. There's not really a value judgment on whether a reasonable person would agree with this. In other words, you look at proximity. It's measurable. How far away is the property from the home itself? You look at, does the property lie within the same enclosure as the home itself? What is the nature of the uses to which that property is put, and has the landowner taken any steps to prevent passersby from looking at or examining those? So those are all factual inquiries. And in addition, if you look at what the United States Supreme Court has identified as the central inquiry in determining whether something is within or without the curtilage, that too is factual. Does the area in question harbor the intimate activity that's associated with the sanctity of a man's home and the privacies of life? I think those are factual determinations. You're really not talking about whether something is or is not reasonable. And I think in some of the cases Justice Bradley referred to, for example, what is the scope of a search incident to arrest? In a lot of those cases, you've got bright line rules that sometimes don't necessarily jive with reality. Like you talk about, into what area can an arrestee reach to secure a weapon? I mean, logically, you would normally look at that as something pretty factual. If the arrestee is somebody who's already been restrained, he's not going to go too far. Or if the arrestee is somebody who happens to be confined to a wheelchair, he's not going to be able to get up and run away. But as a practical matter, the court has established legal rules to say what is the scope what is the area to which an arrestee can reach. And it's more like a legal fiction that's created just because it makes it easier for the police and other law enforcement officials, I think that's one of the reasons anyway, to enforce by having these bright line rules. But in the area of curtilage, it's very difficult to draw these so-called bright line rules.
Here. Well, I have a little trouble with this argument about bright line rules. The example I would have given if I were asking Justice Bradley's question was voluntariness of a confession. That's a constitutional fact that's reviewed de novo, if I remember the cases.
Right, that's the Phillips case, I believe.
And I'm trying to put it into the same context you did. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that you can't introduce an involuntary confession, right?
That's correct.
And I don't know that there are bright line rules for that. I think it's the same thing as this case. Just like you wouldn't say on proximity that there's a X number of feet, right? I mean, you wouldn't say 50 feet out is okay.
No, I think there could be probably some really exaggerated example, like a quarter of a mile is too far to the curtilage if you had a huge piece of property.
Right. So I don't think the bright line rule differentiation between the examples that Justice Bradley gave or voluntary in this case. What you have is a standard, and the standard that the U.S. Supreme Court set up is curtilage, and the whole point of this is to protect privacy of the home and the intimate activity associated with the sanctity. And that's your general standard. It's the same as voluntary is your general standard. And then these are just factors in a totality of circumstances that you consider, as I see it. Right?
Somewhat. Mm-hmm.
Tell me how it's different.
Well, I think that in the curtilage where you've got the four done factors, in a given case, some of the factors won't be very applicable at all. I mean, it really varies in this particular case, and I actually think in most cases, the third factor, the nature of the use to which the area is put, is quite often going to be the determinative one. Because, I mean, there can be situations, obviously, where you change the facts a little, and then maybe the distance will be the determinative one. If you have a house and you've got an attached porch, for example, so it's within a matter of feet of your back door, the court might look at that one factor and say, well, this is obviously something that is, you know, within the curtilage. In a lot of these other situations where you've got, I think, a multitude of factors, there seems to be more weighing going on than there would be in a situation like this. And again, the question a lot of times is reasonableness. That's the ultimate determination. And I'm, you know, probably being redundant, but it seems like the Supreme Court has already determined that once you've got something that's not in your curtilage, then you can't reasonably expect that that is going to be subject to privacy, that it's not going to be subject to the police coming in without a warrant and looking at it, because no matter how many steps you take to protect that evidence, whatever it is, that's not reasonable. Just to give you an example, this court's decision in Conrad, where the sheriff's deputies went on to property and they dug 14 or 15 holes on this farm and they uncovered a body that was buried 3 feet beneath a rock pile. They pushed around the rocks. They pushed around dog houses. Once the determination was made that this property was not part of the curtilage, it made no difference what, you know, precautions the person took. It was no longer reasonable. So the state's view is that you're really making a factual determination, and once that factual determination is made, that controls the question of whether it's reasonable.
Justice Woodcock's question.
No, I was just going to ask, in this case, of course, you're asking two things. You want us to follow the federal courts as far as a factual determination, and secondly, you're saying, well, even if we don't and we go de novo, considering it a constitutional question has been referred to, then you're asking us to use the U.S. Dunn factors and find that this was outside of the curtilage. Just going back to the first question now, and having read some of the record in some of the trial judge's quote observations, I found it difficult if you were to use the Dunn test, the four-factor test, to follow just how this court would arrive. We have to kind of infer certain facts. Do you have any other reading of that? I noticed that opposing counsel indicated that this court should pay no deference to the trial court determination. He said a few other things, but I'll leave those out. But as far as he found it to be very scanty, and he said it lacked the sifting and winnowing. How would we, as an appellate court, do anything other than use a de novo review to actually find out here and go through the entire record ourselves?
I have to agree that the trial court's findings are scanty, and that it makes this court's, or any appellate court's, job more difficult. But there is the general rule that you assume the trial court made findings that would uphold its determination that this property lay outside the curtilage. And I think one way you do that is you look at the arguments that were advanced at the suppression hearing by the district attorney, for example, and the court did say that it was relying on the cases cited by the district attorney. And granted, this is not an ideal way of reviewing a trial court's findings, but one of the points that the district attorney made was, you look at the uses to which this property was being put. Basically, the defendant testified that he went out there to tend his marijuana plants. Now, that certainly is not an activity that is associated with, you know, the intimate functions and privacies of life. And he also went out beyond where the buckets were located to tend to his ginseng and his worms, and he had horse manure back there.
Are those associated with the intimate activities of life?
Ginseng? I don't believe so. If you look at the case law cited in our brief, the Jenkins case federally and Summer, the kinds of activities that courts have said are more intimate are places where you go out and hang your laundry, if you have a sauna located there, an outhouse, things of this nature, not simply going out to cultivate illegal drugs. In fact,
what about cultivating legal flowers?
Well, in the Lane case, our Court of Appeals suggested that the fact that there was a vegetable garden in which the marijuana was growing tended to favor a finding that the garden lay within the curtilage. But if you look at the United States Supreme Court's decision in Oliver, which admittedly preceded Dunn by a couple of years, the court held that, or didn't hold, but stated, it wasn't really necessary, I don't think, to the holding, that cultivating crops was not something that you thought, that the court thought was really an intimate activity of home life.
As I looked at some of the pictures here, I think one of my colleagues said it looked kind of like a Bolivian jungle, but I think it was very difficult to ascertain, except you did indicate that I think it's on Exhibit 27, which we just looked at, that you could just see the outline of the house. I think the officer testified, and I may be wrong, that when he discovered the marijuana pails, that he could not see these sheds at all. He didn't even know they were there. In fact, I don't think he knew sheds were there.
Right, and I tried to ascertain where the sheds were myself, and there were only two photographs that had something in them that possibly could be the sheds, Exhibits 12 and 14. These were photographs introduced by the defendant at the suppression hearing, Exhibits 1 through 25. If those are sheds that I'm seeing in those photographs, they're not the kind of sheds you'd normally, at least I wouldn't normally view. They didn't have solid sides or a solid top. It looked, one of the sheds looked more like a footbridge, and the other picture, it was off to the right, it looked like pieces of wood that were separated so that water, you know, rain could get in or sunlight could get in. It didn't look like the kind of shed that would give any type of privacy whatsoever.
Well, those were the ginseng. I'm not that familiar. I should refer to my colleague who lives up in that area, but I've seen those from the road, and that's what I think is being referred to as the sheds. But those were not visible, as I understand it. The officer went in, observed the pails, and did not see anything else, just saw woods.
That's right. In fact, I would ask the court again. Right. If you stood where the pails were, and you took a photograph towards the sheds, which on the diagram, Exhibit 26, don't appear to be that far apart, you can't see them at all. And Deputy Rausch testified that to that day of the suppression hearing, he was unaware that there was any kind of a structure on the property other than the house itself. So when you look at these photographs, I think the court should come to the conclusion that once you get beyond the tree line, the rest of that property is what legally is known as open fields. Now, the trial court referred to open fields, but the trial court did not use that term in the legal sense. The court used it in the lay term that it wasn't mowed, if the area had not been, you know, mowed down. But open fields simply means something that's unkept, unmaintained, usually distinguished from the manicured or occupied area of property. And here, once you get beyond that tree line, which was approximately 20 feet or so out from the house, you are in the woods. When the deputies came in from the neighboring property, there was really no indication when you were going from the neighbor's land to the other land. These plants were out in the open where anybody who happened to be hiking around, happened to get lost, could have stumbled upon them. It's not a situation where you can clearly tell that these plants somehow belong to that backyard. So really this is a case where I think a picture is worth a thousand words, and if you look at those photos, you can see that there's no way the area in which the plants were located is an area that you can use for the kind of intimate activities associated with being within the curtilage. You couldn't have a picnic back there. You couldn't play croquet or shoes. You couldn't install a hot tub unless you cleared the area. And it's not the kind of garden that existed in Lang, where it was carefully tended. You could see the garden from the house. It was maybe 30 feet away. Vegetables were grown in that garden, which then could be used to feed the residents of the house. This was not that kind of situation at all. The state submits that when you look at the question whether somebody could reasonably expect that that area where the marijuana plants were found should be treated as the home itself, the answer has to be no. And this is the answer you get whether you apply a de novo standard of review where you go ahead and look at the four done factors yourself, or if you apply the clearly erroneous standard that the federal courts do and you examine the trial court's finding that way. So in either event, the state asks this court to uphold the trial court's decision that these plants were outside the curtilage of the Martwick home so that there was no warrant necessary for the officer to snip a leaf from one of the plants. There was no Fourth Amendment violation, and on this basis to reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Could I ask a question, Chief?
Certainly.
This is a hypothetical question. Does the posting of property have any impact on the determination of curtilage?
I would say very, very slight, because the United States Supreme Court in Oliver said that just because you put up no trespassing signs or you take other measures to protect your privacy doesn't mean you can transform what would otherwise be open fields into curtilage. So even though it comes in slightly under the fourth Dunn factor, that in and of itself I don't think weighs very heavily. That's why the state's view is that of the four factors, the most useful really in the vast majority of cases is the third one, the nature of the uses to which the property is put. But again, in a given case, the distance alone could rule out something as being curtilage. You could have something that's just too far away from the house to be considered its logical extension. But the answer to your question, I don't think it would weigh very heavily.
Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Moeller. Representing the defendant appellant, Thomas Marcus, is Robert Marsh.
The court, please. My name is Robert Rush. I represent the defendant respondent, Thomas Martwick. The first question the court is asked to answer in this question is, what is the appropriate standard of review on questions of curtilage? The defense respectfully submits that it is a constitutional fact question which is to be decided on the two-step approach, namely that historical facts touching on an issue are to be reviewed deferentially, and that the ultimate fact question, whether an area searched is within the curtilage of a home, is a constitutional fact which may and should be reviewed independently. I respectfully submit to this court that answer is compelled by the very recent and thoughtful decision of this court in State of Wisconsin versus Phillips, the 1998 decision, which was discussed previously in the colloquy between the court and counsel. Phillips is at 218 Wisconsin 2nd 180. In that case, in the Phillips case, the state asked the court to apply the deferential standard of review on voluntariness of consent questions, and this court declined. This court determined that it had historically used the two-step standard of review for a variety of constitutional challenges, including, number one, independent source questions, number two, denial of attorney questions, three, waiver Miranda, four, violation of Fifth Amendment rights, five, whether a confession was voluntary. Six, voluntariness of a guilty plea. 7 was the right of silence honored, and 8 did probable cause for arrest exist. The defense respectfully submits that there is no meaningful difference between that type of determination and the one that you're being asked to determine here today, whether the search took place within curtilage.
Mr. Rush, how do you get around the case of Ball versus State? I understand that in that case, this court, looking at the question of curtilage, said that whether property was or was not within the curtilage was a question of fact.
Yes. Your Honor, I would respond first of all by saying that the specific language used in Ball was, quote, that it is a question of fact. It did not say whether it was a question of evidentiary fact or a question of constitutional fact. Now, I would have to acknowledge that the court probably inferred an one of evidentiary fact. I can only say that the development of the law in the last 30 years has been such, I think there's been a refinement in thinking and addressing that issue. That would be my response.
Let me ask you, because I have a lot of trouble with this myself, how would you draw the line? What do you use to draw the line between constitutional fact and evidentiary or historical fact?
Your Honor, I'm very, if I may, just personally say, I'm glad to hear you say you're confused, because I'm confused, because in State versus Lange, the court noted that the differentiation is a fuzzy one, and it's a difficult one to make.
Frequently they're the same, aren't they? Frequently they are the same.
I think they may well be. Constitutional fact is defined as one in which a constitutional issue is determined. That was the definition cited in Lange. And it would seem to me that when we are determining whether a search occurs within curtilage, and that means whether it's occurring within home, because there's no difference between the search of home and curtilage, the same level of protection, the Fourth Amendment protection attends to both, that is a question of constitutional fact.
Well, counsel, to follow up, what if the finding of the trial court was that in northern Wisconsin, this type of place is traditionally considered to be part of the home? Is that a finding of historical fact, a finding of constitutional fact, or both?
I believe it could be both. Obviously, I would like to know more within the decision in which that statement were made, but I believe that it is in a situation where it can be both. It would seem to me it comes closest, that statement alone comes closest to an evidentiary fact.
Counsel, what was the curtilage in this case, from your point of view?
Your Honor, I would begin to answer the question by pointing out that my client's entire lot was a small one, 1.56 acres. That it was a platted lot next to a subdivision in a residential area, and I believe that while it's not necessary in my case to claim that the entire lot was curtilage, I don't think that that is an outlandish position to take, especially because the lot was really fell on only three categories. Approximately 100 feet from the road was the house, the structure. And I'm referring here to a sketch map, exhibit number 26. And a small area of about 20 to 30 feet immediately around the house was devoid of trees. And thereafter, the entire lot was trees and undergrowth.
Now, I hate to interrupt you, but I will. And that's the part you just said. around the house was this cleared area. Now, normally when you talk about curtilage, you have the home, and then you have this defined area next to it. It would seem to me, and you can argue contrary to this, as I'm sure you will, that you're taking the whole lot, which is 413 feet by one side and 333 feet on the other and 260 feet, and saying that's it, that's the curtilage, and that seems to defy, quote, a reasonable interpretation. I think the reasonable interpretation would be that that area that you just defined around the house would be curtilage, because 20 feet from the house we have this, as I described it, one of my colleagues said it looked like a Bolivian jungle. It was typical North Woods or whatever. It was trees and brush, and you could not see through it. So that would seem to me to be more obvious than saying the entire lot.
General, I would respond by saying this, that position, I think, takes an extremely narrow and unworkable approach to the issue of curtilage. Curtilage is more than simply an area through which one may easily pass. It is the areas associated with the house and which are intimately connected with the house. The area in which the marijuana was found was an area that was described by all witnesses as an area from 50 to the most of 75 feet from the house. 50 from 10 to 75, that's right. And it was behind the house. That is, this house was oriented to a street, and there was a front door. And then in the back, there is a back door, and there is a path that leads to the garden area. And it is along this path that the search took place. I would respond in part to your
question. Is that how the officer came in, along the path? I thought he came in from an adjacent lot and just was walking through the brush. This is what the record says, and came upon this quote, faint, well, she described it as trampled grass, and then found the pails which had marijuana. And it was in the woods. That's why I say it was 20 or 30 feet in the woods.
Well, Your Honor, this is correct. He certainly walked through the woods. The vast majority of my client's land is wooded. He has kept it wooded. It is a natural fence. The whole purpose of the woods is to prevent public intrusion and to increase the degree of privacy. But if I may just go back to the prior question you've asked, I would respectfully suggest that the fact that you have stored these items on this path between your house and the garden is significant. Now, in the rebuttal brief, I'm taken to task for calling the area the garden, and I'd like to respond to that. First off, I point out that the Court of Appeals categorized it as a garden. But more importantly, I think that it's an appropriate term. A garden is an area of soil worked by a gardener for some form of crop. And my client is certainly not a typical gardener, I grant you that. His crops were worms, presumably for fishing. And he apparently had a pile of manure.
That's typical.
Typical, all right. And then he had the great ginseng operation. I'm delighted that Justice Bradley is here, because Marathon County is the seat of an extensive ginseng cultivation process, and I think the court is aware that it is a natural crop that's cultivated by replicating the conditions of a forest, and you create sheds on poles, and then you have a wooden structure on top of the sheds to break the light. So you have a mixture of sunlight and shade. And that was on the far end of my client's property. And I believe that these two areas, the worm operation and the ginseng operation, may be described as a garden. At least that was the intent that I intended, and there clearly, the point here is that the path connects this garden area to the house. And gardens have historically been viewed as a part of the house, and I would respectfully submit that that is a major factor cutting in favor of determining the location of the search to be within the curtilage.
Isn't that, though, if I could interrupt for a minute, isn't that an argument for a deferential standard of review, though, and let the local magistrates, the local judges make these determinations? I mean, I'm from Milwaukee. We don't have gardens like this in Milwaukee. We have other sorts of gardens and other sorts of curtilage questions that are presented. And so isn't that an argument for the local judges and the trial court judges making these determinations?
I believe the answer to that is both yes and no. It is certainly yes in the sense that, in the way that you particularly pose that, the question of the historical facts to which this land were used are evidentiary facts, and they do deserve deferential treatment. And that is step number one of the two-step analysis. But the ultimate question of whether it was curtilage is, in my opinion, a constitutional fact which deserves no deferential treatment.
Counsel, I have one couple other questions on this curtilage, because how do you distinguish your 1.52 acres from the neighbors? As I understand it, and maybe I've got the wrong concept, that it was not distinguishable at the border lines. In other words, you could go from lot A to lot B to lot C, and it all looked the same. Is that the way, I mean, that's what I thought.
You know, I'm not entirely certain that is the case. The record was not entirely clear as to what the neighbor's property looked like. There was testimony that immediately across the street is the Wilson Flowage, and there were a variety of structures and residences. To what extent the lots on those residences were manicured, I must candidly say I do not know.
Well, you indicated that your client, the defendant, kept his lot this way because he wanted privacy, and I was interpreting that to mean that others had theirs manicured. And my understanding was that it all looked the same.
Well, Your Honor,
the edges of the lot. So you're trying to define a curtilage. How would you define the edge of the curtilage if you couldn't tell where the edge of the lot was?
Well, I would point out that the edge of the lot line is simply one factor. I certainly the lot line is the ultimate boundary. No one can argue that it could be further than that. I would respectfully submit, though, that we can avoid the difficulty of that question, because there's no question the officer here testified that the seizure of the marijuana plant occurred in an area only 50 to 75 feet max from the house.
In the woods.
I would respectfully...
Suppose Robert Frost had been a native and had seen this woods lovely, dark, and deep, and taken a walk in the woods.
On the path less traveled.
On the path less traveled. Any problem here?
Your Honor, if I may, it seemed to me that when you asked your question, counsel, that you may have been reflecting on the changes, recent changes, statutory changes to the Wisconsin trespass law. Did I read too much into your question?
He doesn't have to answer it.
I ask the questions.
Well, I point out that there are recent changes in Wisconsin trespass law, and they have removed the need to post land. Major change. Legislative change that said it's no longer necessary to post land. All land is presumed posted, and it is a trespass unless you have the affirmative permission of the landowner. It seems to me that that is a strong expression of the Wisconsin government to give a greater degree of protection to the landowner and a greater recognition by government of the right of a landowner to expect privacy and non-trespass on his land. I agree it's not determinative of the issue, but I believe that it is appropriate to take into consideration.
Well, then, if we had 100-acre property, wooded property, would that be the curtilage?
No, I've never seen any case to suggest an area like that. The outer boundaries have gone, if I recall correctly, like 300 or 400 feet, depending upon what were out there. There were any number of cases where there were barns, let's say, 300 or 400 feet away, and it's been determined that the curtilage should extend that far. Now, the curtilage historically was the area within the fence, wherever you built that fence, and some fences were far and some fences were close.
I want to go back to Robert Frost for a minute on the 1.2 acres. Isn't it perfectly natural in an area that is not fully secluded here for people to have wandered through that woods? It's almost an enticing woods to walk through, and they see five plants in the buckets. Why didn't the man grow his marijuana indoors? Isn't it probable that sooner or later someone would have walked through that woods?
I think not, Your Honor. I respond by respectfully pointing out the North Woods is also loaded with wood ticks and with mosquitoes. And while it's all there and much of it is not posted, actually the summer use of our areas are very limited. Speaking as a coordinated Ice Age trail, I can tell you in Taylor County, our summer use of the trail is minuscule compared to the use in fall. I would grant you that when conditions get better, there is some use, but here's an area that I think it was extremely unlikely that anyone was going to just wander through.
Are you suggesting a seasonal curtilage?
No.
Well, I'm just your response was that people might wander at different times, but I think it would have to be something that would be year-round.
Well,
in the winter as well as in the summertime, or when these pictures were taken.
I would only point this out, that one of the legal questions is, expectation of privacy, and I would respectfully suggest that an individual could reasonably expect not to find many people out in the middle of the woods of North Wisconsin during summer. That was my only point.
Counsel, from where I'm located to the end of this courtroom, how far do you think that is?
98 feet.
Give or take a couple of inches, or is that your best estimate?
Yes, yes.
So the ginseng garden from the back of the house, assuming that you're in the ballpark, would be, I think, 50 to 75 feet. So.
No, the ginseng garden would be a bit beyond. Would be further.
The marijuana was found on the path, 50 to 75.
That's correct, John.
Mm-hmm. Was this marijuana observable from other lots? Is that part of the record?
Absolutely not. The record is uncontroverted that one could not see the marijuana until you were practically on top of it. And you could not see it from any public place. In Phillips, this court also noted that the two-step standard of review was applied to a variety of search and seizure issues, including whether under the Fourth Amendment a student had a reasonable expectation of privacy in a locker. Two, whether a consensual search of a home was sufficiently attenuated under Fourth Amendment from prior searches and other search and seizure issues. I would respectfully suggest that there is no meaningful difference between deciding those issues and one curtilage. I would next like to move on to the issue of whether, because the majority of the federal courts have used a evidentiary test, whether the same should be applied here. I can respectfully point out that this court has largely done my homework, because that same issue was dealt with in this court just a year ago in the Phillips case. In the Phillips case, you had the identical situation where the federal courts were apparently deciding the issue on an evidentiary test. This court declined to follow the federal lead because of a articulated policy decision. That policy decision was, quote, that the court's decision to utilize the two-step approach does not turn on whether the underlying determination of the circuit court was fact-specific. Rather, the principal reason for independent appellate review of matters of constitutional fact is to provide uniformity in constitutional decision-making. It is the duty of the reviewing court to independently apply constitutional principles to the facts found by the circuit court, because the scope of constitutional protection representing the basic values and commitments of our society cannot vary from the trial court. I would like now to pass on to the issue of the adequacy of the trial court's findings in this case. And you are correct. I've been very critical of them. I frankly do not believe that the trial court's brief and inadequate findings are deserving of deferential treatment. I say that with the utmost respect to the trial court. The trial court's entire decision, counting all articles, it were 187 words. And permit me to read them. The court, Judge Madden deciding the issue. Maybe the counsel thought the court spoke too soon, but I don't believe I did. The court there is referring to the fact that the court had previously interrupted counsel and decided that it had heard enough and decided the issue, and the court was induced, was able to talk the court into hearing additional evidence and then heard additional evidence and made this ruling. I look at all of the information provided, all of the testimony provided, all of the evidence provided, and I find that the interest law enforcement curbing illegal activity is sufficient, the concern of this court. The court reiterates that this officer proceeded cautiously with information which he believed to be reliable. He had private, previous information of his own. He proceeded to verify that information. I'm of the opinion, let the appellate court proceed as they see fit, but there are no open fields in this particular area. This is wooded area. This is the Northwood, and that's what it looks like, and this is outside the curtilage. I am clearly of the opinion, and based on the case law cited by Mr. Schilling, the district attorney, I'm further of the opinion that this is outside the curtilage. There is no expectation of privacy in that particular area, and that the warrant then was appropriately sought, appropriately drafted, appropriately executed, and the court then and therefore denies the motion, period. That was the entirety of the court's findings. I would respectfully submit that those are inadequate. There is no weighing and sifting of the facts. I would respectfully submit that the Court of the Appeals decision in this case is an appropriate one. And I ask that you affirm the court, the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rush. Are there any questions? Justice Brasman.
I'm not unsympathetic to your position on curtilage. What I am extremely concerned about, however, is when you take the view that the curtilage is the entire 1.5 acres, if we held that, wouldn't we almost be creating a protection for marijuana growers across Wisconsin? I mean, you just design the lot this way. You surround it with woods. You don't. I mean, wouldn't that hamper law enforcement incredibly?
Your Honor, I'm not asking this court to determine that the boundaries of the lot are the curtilage. I'm asking the court to take a far narrower position, that an area 50 to 75 feet from the home and on the pathway, the mowed pathway between the house and the garden, is within curtilage. I certainly recognize that that has a impact on law enforcement, but I believe it is an appropriate one. The search warrant requirement of the Constitution applies to houses. This was an individual in which, a situation in which the police sought a search warrant and were told their information was stale. What they then did is they went out to the property, and I don't mean to make light of a situation, but I've always found this to be a bit of black humor. They sought permission of the neighbor across the street to park the squad. And then they trespassed on my client's land, went through his entire land to find the marijuana. I find that offensive of the principles of the Fourth Amendment.
Did they walk through curtilage then? In your opinion, even if you say the buckets are outside the curtilage, did they walk through?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Even if you would say, which I know you are not, that the buckets are outside the curtilage, did they walk through curtilage to get there?
Your Honor, the exact route is unknown. The path by which they came to the curtilage is unknown. I can say that I would suspect they did, because I think it was natural first to go to the house and proceed out from the house.
Well, do you accept the four Dunn factors as the constitutional test?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
So proximity, 50 to 75 feet, you think is in proximate relation to the house, I gather.
Yes.
Was there an enclosure?
The question of enclosure is the question of the fence. The officer testified that he tripped over an object which was about a foot from the ground and which may have been a fence.
Now, is this foot from the ground thing all around the property or just in certain parts?
It was never defined.
Okay. The next factor is the nature of the use. So here, I mean, whether it's legal or illegal, you'll get that classified, I assume, as gardening or tending plants in a neutral way, right? Because just because it's illegal wouldn't make it in or out of the curtilage, right?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, you asked.
The nature of the use here,
yes,
was growing an illegal plant, but the legality of the plant should not affect whether this is curtilage, right?
Well, actually, I believe the evidence showed that the plants were primarily grown inside the home and then were taken out periodically to get the benefit of the outside. The primary use of the area was not an unlawful use. It was with the yard area and the pathway to the garden.
So it's gardening was the nature of the use here.
Yes.
And the last done factor is what steps were taken to hide the area, to give it privacy.
And there, the answer is that he allowed nature to do it. Nature created a veritable fence that was impenetrable to public view.
So your application of the Dunn factors would reach to a different result than the application of the state of these same factors. Your conclusion from applying the Dunn factors is the opposite to the conclusion that the state reaches applying the same factors.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, just the fourth factor as far as letting nature do the fighting of the marijuana. We're still not with a defined area. You said we should use the entire lot. And then you said, well, no, we didn't think we ought to use the entire lot. Well, how much of the woods should we use?
Your Honor, I think that every portion of the woods would have to be looked at individually. There was no intensive scrutiny of the other portions because they weren't pertinent. All I can say is that the particular portion of the woods had significant human traffic by way of my client's human traffic. It was on the mold path, which he kept open and was routinely used by him.
Regardless of what standard of review this court settles on, it cannot be said that the marijuana plants the deputies discovered lay inside the curtilage. In California versus Serrallo, which I cited on page 13 of the state's brief in chief, the Supreme Court of the United States defined curtilage in the following manner. The protection afforded the curtilage is essentially a protection of families and personal privacy in an area intimately linked to the home, both physically and psychologically, where privacy expectations are most heightened. Now, by no stretch of the imagination can it be said that this area lying between 50 to 75 feet from the home, which you cannot see from the home, you cannot see the buckets, and which is not in an area where you're doing anything other than going to tend to worms, horse manure, and ginseng, beyond that point at least, is something so physically and psychologically associated with the home that we're willing to accord the protections given to homeowners to activity in that area.
Ms. Bowler, let me interrupt you for a minute. When Mr. Rush was wrapping up a couple minutes ago, he mentioned that these buckets were next to a mowed pathway. Is there any dispute in that regard? Was indeed this pathway a mowed pathway?
I don't believe it was really mowed. The picture that the state introduced that was taken to supposedly highlight what the path looked like was exhibit number either 27 or 28. I think it was 28. And if you look at it, what it appears to be is tall grass that was flattened down by virtue of foot traffic. And the defendant took the stand and testified, I don't know if I have his exact words, but once in a while he would use a brush cutter to clear it out. So it was not the kind of path that was really discernible going, you know, from the house all the way back to the sheds. The path started approximately 10 feet from the house. Prior to that, there was apparently some gravel area, and then you can see where the grass is kind of flattened down. But the photo in the record just shows a very small segment. There was really no indication that it was a mowed path all the way from 10 feet away from the house to where the ginseng and worms were located.
Had there been a path, would your conclusion be different?
No, it would not.
It's not a relevant factor.
I think, you know, if it was something where it was a paved path, it might have some more bearing on it, but I don't think that's the critical distinction here. I think the way the property was situated, where once you got beyond the tree line, you're in the woods. It doesn't appear to anybody else that once you're in the woods that this is part of the defendant's backyard, that's a very critical factor. And I'm quoting from our brief at page 19 to give you an example of a situation in which a court has found a manicured portion of a yard to be part of the curtilage, and then once you get beyond that, it's not. the Sixth Circuit in United States versus Jenkins, and that's a circuit that uses a de novo standard or independent standard of review for curtilage determination, said the defendant's backyard is clearly demarked as a continuation of the home itself. No one could mistake the yard and its neatly mowed lawn and garden arrangements for the unkept open fields composing the remaining portion of defendant's rural property. And I think a similar analysis applies here. Once you get beyond the tree line or the wood line and you're out in the woods, you can't tell whose property is whose. In regard to the question that one of the justices asked about what route the deputies took, if you look at Exhibit 26, I think Mr. Roush had asked the deputy to draw with a red pen how they came from the neighbor's property, and that red pen does show the route that they took from the next door neighbors. It's true you can't tell whether the neighbor's property was similarly wooded, but there's no evidence to the contrary, and the deputies testified that you really couldn't tell whose property you were on. There were no special fences showing that this is one person's land and this is where the next person's land begins.
Counsel, in your earlier comments, and I'm paraphrasing it, but close, you said something like, the ultimate determination in search cases is reasonableness. Is that correct? Did I have that approximately right? The ultimate determination in any search case is reasonableness?
I think that in the, I was referring to a lot of the examples that you had given about the ultimate determination being one of constitutional fact, and I came back by saying that in most of those cases, the question was, were the actions taken reasonable?
Isn't the ultimate question in a curtilage case also whether or not the search was a reasonable search within the scope allotted? Isn't it also a reasonableness determination in curtilage?
I don't believe so, because just because you find, for example, you decide that something is within the curtilage, let's say, that doesn't automatically mean that what the deputies did was reasonable or unreasonable, because you can have something that's within the curtilage and yet you expose it to public view. So somebody makes an observation or peers into your house. So the question of curtilage itself is something subsidiary before you ever reach the question of reasonableness. But if you find that something is not within the curtilage, then you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy as to that item.
In the O'Brien case, that was last year's case, the truck was 200 feet. And my recollection is that was considered in that kind of setting in sufficient proximity, correct, to be within the protected area within the curtilage?
My memory is not real good on the facts in O'Brien. I'm familiar basically with the case, but I don't recall if that too.
Wasn't that a search warrant?
Whether it was in the scope of the warrant?
Maybe
right.
The scope of the warrant and an opportunity that the product that was being searched for could be physically within that area.
Your position, I don't want to misstate it, your position would be it was perfectly lawful for law enforcement officers in this situation to go on to the property.
Not that it was lawful within the Fourth Amendment, not that it was lawful under state law. There has to be a distinction made between trespass law and Fourth Amendment law, and I think if you look at Oliver versus United States, the Supreme Court did that very well, saying the law of trespass forbids intrusions upon land that the Fourth Amendment would not proscribe. For trespass law extends to instances where the exercise of the right to exclude vindicates no legitimate privacy interest. So you can sometimes you can trespass all you want, like the deputies did in the Conrad case, or even in United States versus Dunn. Those law enforcement officers went on the defendant's property not once but twice to make various observations. They climbed over several interior fences. They took their flashlights and looked inside Dunn's barn. Those were all trespasses. Those were all things for which you presumably could sue them civilly, but those were not considered to be Fourth Amendment violations because they did not occur within the curtilage.
So under the Fourth Amendment, the officers had come on the property, and if the house were the back wall, how far could they keep walking before they were violating the Fourth Amendment?
In this particular case, based on the record as what we have before us anyway, I would say until they got to the tree line. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moeller. That concludes our argument on 98-0101 CR.